So the subject is the Born rule unstable in quantum gravity? And from the way I've phrased it, you might guess that I'm going to suggest that maybe it is. Some of the ideas go back to a couple of papers here on the archive. There's some new material in this talk that I'm just writing up. All right, let me, what is the talk about? Here's a quick sketch of what the talk is about. First, I'm going to give you an example of a theory in which the Born rule is stable, in the sense that you can imagine deviations from the Born rule, but the theory is able to describe a situation where you begin with the Born rule and you stay there. Okay, it's stable in that sense. I'll describe it properly later. And the example I'm going to look at is the pilot wave theory of de Broglie and Bohm. Then I'm going to give, now this theory is primarily discussed in the absence of gravitation. You've got particles or fields moving in the background, Minkowski space-time. It has also been discussed on expanding space, usually a globally hyperbolic space-time. I'm going to give three arguments for the instability of the Born rule in gravitational physics. Right? The suggestion is that this property, the stability of the Born rule, might be destroyed by gravity. Now, the first two arguments are really just sort of little warm-up, brief arguments, which are discussed in detail in the two papers that I've mentioned here. The argument I really want to focus on in this talk is the third one. But the first one is that in a non-globally hyperbolic space-time, possibly the stability of the Born rule runs into trouble. Another issue is pilot wave theory. That something goes wrong with the dynamics at points where the wave function vanishes and you need to regularize it. And it's possible that this could also create an instability in the Born rule. I'll discuss these briefly. And these two are sort of warm-up discussions to sort of get you open your minds to the idea that, well, maybe something could go wrong with the stability of the Born rule. And then I really want to get into the deep quantum gravity regime with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and argue that there is no conserved quantum current in this theory, and that I'm going to argue that, in fact, the Born rule just has no role perhaps it should have no role in this theory. I'm then going to give you a quantum gravitational model for quantum instability that is based partially on work that Klaus Kiefer has been doing since the early 90s, with a lot of application to an inflationary universe and a speculative laboratory experiment that I'll discuss, and then end with some discussion. So, all right, quickly then, what is de Broglie's pilot wave theory? It was a theory presented in 1927 originally for a many-body non-relativistic low-energy system. You have the many-body wave function, which de Broglie called a pilot wave, and he interpreted it not as a probability wave, but as an actual wave that guides the motion of an individual system according to this equation of motion, this equation of motion for velocities. And as usual, I give my one line. For people who have never heard of this, you've probably heard of the WKB approximation. You have a WKB wave function, and there's always this statement that you can associate classical trajectories by putting the momentum equal to the gradient of the phase, which is just this equation. So it's the same equation, except we're applying it to any wave function, not just a WKB. And of course, this can be applied to any system with a wave function on a configuration space. This configuration could be a field on space-time. It could actually be a three geometry, as we'll be talking about later. Anyway, it was shown by Bohm in 1952 that if, the, I mean, so this, sorry, this is a dynamics of individual systems. It's a deterministic dynamics of single systems. If I consider an ensemble of systems with the same initial wave function with a distribution of initial configurations, then I can discuss the time evolution of this distribution. And it was shown by Bohm that if the initial distribution is equal to p is psi squared, then you recover the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics.
Not just in the WTV approximation.
No. Any wave function, any wave function. Now, let me just say, the thing I want to focus on here is this idea that p is psi squared is preserved in time by the dynamics. It's stable in this sense that once you're in equilibrium, you're stuck in equilibrium. Okay, now just to make sure that everyone, you know, those who've never seen this before, make sure you understand this. Let's just look at one particle. The mathematics is actually exactly the same. You've got a many-body system, if you've got a field theory, if you, whatever configuration. Your one particle, the Schrödinger equation, remember this psi is not a probability wave. It's a wave that guides an individual system. The Schrödinger equation implies this continuity equation for psi squared with a certain, for what you might think of as a velocity field. This is the quantum current. Okay, there's a grad S over M here. De Broglie says, in addition to the wave, there's a particle moving. It has a trajectory, a deterministic trajectory determined by this equation of motion. In other words, the velocity of the particle is just equal to this factor here. Now, if I have an ensemble of particles moving with that velocity field, then an arbitrary distribution of particles must, by construction, evolve in accordance with this equation. This equation just says I have this ensemble of particles moving with these velocities. Now notice, hang on, these are exactly the same partial differential equations. P and psi squared obey the same PDE. So there's a simple theorem that if P and psi squared are initially equal, then they remain equal for all t.
So more than one particle, that grad is not just a gradient in space.
No, more than one particle here. So for the ith particle, you take the gradient with respect to the ith particle. So this is a many-body system here. It generalizes to. In fact, I think, have I got a slide? Hang on, I've got a slide here. Look, the same thing works. Basically, if I have a system with a configuration wave functional, and I have a Schrödinger-like equation, where something we showed in a paper with Stroyer, that if the Hamiltonian is given by a differential operator, you can always find a conserved quantum current that obeys a continuity equation like this, and you can define a de Broglie velocity field, and by construction, rho will obey the same continuity equation, and so again, rho is psi squared is preserved in time. The Born rule is stable in the sense that once you're there, you're stuck there. Quick note, this is it's a non-local theory. This dynamics, if I have two particles that are entangled, the motion of one particle depends instantaneously on what is done over here. If I change the local Hamiltonian here, the motion of this particle will respond instantaneously, even if it's on the other side of the galaxy. It's a highly non-local theory. And in the, at least the way I view it, it requires an underlying preferred foliation of space-time with, this is a preferred time parameter, okay? And you can do this clearly in any globally hyperbolic space-time, you can, in fact, we're gonna look at that very soon. All right, now.
I have just a historical question.
Yes.
Did De Broglie view this as a wave in configuration space, higher dimensional space? I have a little book.
Sorry, did De Broglie want? I didn't catch the question.
Did he view the wave function in a higher dimensional configuration space or in physical space? Because I have a little book.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So yeah, I have. So the book I co-authored with Guido, we went into a lot of the history of this. So De Broglie, what he was doing in the 1920s, he was modeling particles as singularities in waves in three space.
Yeah, that's
with coupled differential equations he couldn't solve. And he postulated that if you could solve these equations, that the motions of the singularities would follow this equation of motion, where S is the phase of the Schrödinger wave function. Okay, but he couldn't prove it. It was a postulate. He thought that if he could solve this coupled this theorem, I've got these three space fields with singular singularities. If I could solve this system, this is what you would get. What he did in 1927, just before the Fifth Solvay Conference, is he said, look, actually, you could postulate just a provisional theory. He called it a provisional theory, where he said, let's forget about these three space waves and singularities. Let's just postulate these equations as a provisional theory, which he hoped later you could derive from this other theory in three space. And this is the theory he presented at the 1927 Solvay Conference.
The higher dimensional
one. Oh, yes, with a wave in configuration space. Absolutely. Wave in configuration space. Now,
was this theory local, the one in the...
Well, it's not clear. I mean, I think his hope was that it was local, but it wasn't clear. But what I could say, I mean, there's an interesting parallel with what de Broglie did and what Newton did way back. You know, Newton didn't believe in action at a distance. He believed in local action by contact. He thought that gravitation was caused by some material medium in space and so on. He proposed this theory of gravity as a sort of provisional effective theory. And for the rest of his life, he was kind of torn over this. De Broglie, similarly, he wasn't comfortable with this. The way I look at it, de Broglie discovered pilot wave dynamics somewhat involuntarily. He saw that you could propose this provisional theory, but he hoped it would come from something ultimately based in three space. So that's... But the details, there's a lot about this in my book with Guido, which is freely available on the archive, by the way. If you want to buy a copy, 5% of the cost goes to a good cause. So there you go. Anyway, moving on. So here's what I want to... that's the background now. Now let me get on. In pilot wave theory, the Born rule is stable in two senses. First sense, that this rho is psi squared is an equilibrium state, by which I mean if it's true at t is zero, it remains true later on. The second sense in which it's stable is that deviations from equilibrium relax to equilibrium, at least in appropriate conditions. See my colloquium yesterday. Those who weren't here, I was discussing extensive numerical simulations have shown that if you start out of equilibrium, if the wave function is in particular a superposition of a significant number of different energy states, you get relaxation to equilibrium. Now, in this talk, I'm concerned mainly with the first point. I'm not particularly interested in relaxation. I'm interested in the existence of an equilibrium state described by the Born rule, or in fact, perhaps indeed by any rule. And our central question is there an equilibrium state in the deep quantum gravity regime? And the suggestion is that there is not. So it's just sense one that I'm focusing on here. All right, why would you think that there is not a conserved Born rule, stable Born rule in the gravitational regime? So warm-up argument number one, and I'm going to be sort of brief and because I want to get on to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but warm-up argument number one. There is already reason to doubt the stability of quantum equilibrium at the level of quantum field theory in a classical space-time background. And here is my argument, that the stability is clear on a background globally hyperbolic space-time, as I'll show you in the next slide. But the space-time generated by the formation and evaporation of a black hole is arguably not globally hyperbolic, but this is controversial. And it seems to me that it's unclear how to demonstrate the existence of a stable state of quantum equilibrium in a non-globally hyperbolic space-time. So let me explain here. Let's first look at a globally hyperbolic space-time. So here I have my usual Laplace and shift functions. I've got a space-time that can be foliated by space-like hypersurfaces labeled by a time function. And if you're looking at it classically, it's globally hyperbolic. It means that if I have initial conditions on some initial space-like slice, those conditions determine the entire space-time with no holes, no gaps. It's you can cover everything. That's global hyperbolicity. Let's consider a massless and minimally coupled real scalar field. I guess is my favorite little example that's simple and easy to work with. And just with a standard Lagrangian density, you quantize it. What does the Schrödinger equation look like? I have a wave functional. So I'm in the functional, what's often called the functional Schrödinger picture. I have a wave functional, okay, on the field configuration space that obeys a functional Schrödinger equation that looks like this. And from that, you can derive a continuity equation. Now, you know, for those who have not seen this kind of thing before, this is really exactly the same as this, except you're in an infinite dimensional space where each dimension of the space is the value of a field at one point. It's actually just the same thing. So here is what it looks like. You've got a continuity equation. This is a density on the field configuration space. And you can define a de Broglie velocity field so this is the time evolution of the field on space-time. And of course, if I can now consider an arbitrary ensemble of fields, by construction, it will obey this continuity equation. And again, there's this simple theorem that, hey, presto, look, these are the same functional partial differential equations. If p equals psi squared initially, it will remain psi squared. So, you know, it's the same simple theorem. I've got a stable state of quantum equilibrium. The Born rule is preserved. You can easily, you know, on a globally hyperbolic space-time, no problem.
It should be valid for any time function that you have.
Yeah. Ah, sorry, no, okay. I should have stressed again, as I mentioned here, that this requires an underlying preferred foliation. There is an assumption, because this theory is non-local, so the time evolution of the field here will depend instantaneously on values of the field over here. So in this theory, you know, you see, from the point of view of starting with the classical theory, you say, well, here's a classical space-time. Of course, there are many different possible foliations. The theory is constructed on the assumption that, well, one of these foliations is the preferred one, okay? And of course, really, you're looking at it backwards, because if this is the underlying, the right way to look at it is that this is the fundamental theory. You've got a three geometry evolving in time, where time is just time. It's just a parameter which is an absolute parameter. And there is non-locality acting across this three geometry, okay? This traces out an evolution. It traces out a space-time. And the space-time in the classical limit, you should recover, you know, your classical space-time. And in the classical limit, you then see, well, actually, I can slice things differently. But in the underlying theory, there is a preferred foliation. You know, there's no...
But for any n, this should be valid? Or no, this n is fixed with the foliation?
Yeah, oh, it's defined by the foliation. It's defined by the foliation. So, n is fixed by the foliation. Sorry, yes, so here... So, you know, there are, hang on, do I have anything more I could say about that? It's, there is, for a given, here I've got a background, I've been saying something, what I just said, I was getting muddled because my mind is jumping ahead to the discussion about the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I was talking about an evolving three geometry. Sorry, what I just said has got nothing to do with this. Can we please delete, who's recording this? Can we please delete that minute segment? Sorry, I got completely, here we're talking about, we've just got a given classical four-dimensional space-time background that's given. Okay, and what's evolving here is just the massless real scalar field. Now, what we do, if you say, right, here is, here's a given classical four-dimensional space-time, and I want to discuss the de Broglie-Bohm theory of the time evolution of a scalar field on it. Okay, well, you have to tell me we have to select a slicing. Okay, we have to select a Laplace function and say, look, this is the true slicing. And then write down these equations, okay? And then I've got a non-local theory with respect to that slicing that gives a time evolution of the scalar field, not of the three geometry. Sorry, I misquote. And of course, you might say, well, how do you know which is the true slicing? Well, out of equilibrium, if you were out of equilibrium, if the field here was entangled with the field there, you would be able to send non-local signals, and you'll be able to operationally determine which is the true slicing. So, you know, there's a kind of internal logic to this.
Isn't it, despite the fact that you deleted that particular minute, wasn't what you said correct, that N is in fact determined by your choice of foliation?
Yes.
Even though it's not a dynamical space-time, but...
If
you've chosen the foliation, then you know what N is.
Well, that's right, yes, that's correct, yes.
The only thing, however, that raises the question, what about N sub I? That you don't yet know.
Right, so N sub I...
choose that too, or is that...
So N sub I, the way when I think about this, I usually think, look, if it's globally hyperbolic, and if you're not running into singularities, you can just set N sub I equal to zero. Want to be simple, but N sub I is really, you know, it's just your coordinate, you know, how do your spatial coordinates vary on the foliation? That's just a coordinate arbitrariness.
Right, but does that end up, I assume that ends up not influencing the evolution?
No. In fact, I'm trying to think now. Sorry, I copied these equations from the paper in 2004. I think I may have set N sub I equal to zero. Hang on, let me just think. N sub I. Sorry, Rafa, I'd have to think about it. I think I may have set N sub I equal to zero here, but I think if it wasn't zero, I don't think it's going to. Does it appear in these equations? It's not going to appear. I don't think it appears in these equations. N sub I is just part of the. The three coordinates, how you've defined your spatial coordinates, how they vary from one hypersurface to another. But anyway, let me move on, because what I want to suggest is that, well, hang on, you can't make this construction in a space-time that's been generated by the formation and complete evaporation of a black hole. There is this idea, again, this is supposed to be my brief warm-up argument. So let me just go quickly. The argument is that, look, you know, your space-like hypersurfaces, are not Cauchy surfaces, and the resulting space-time, because of the presence of this singularity here, is not globally hyperbolic. But this is controversial. Okay, the information on this surface does not determine everything that happens here, because of this point here, but there's still a controversial discussion about this. But my question, let's just take it that this process does create a non-globally hyperbolic space-time. The question would then be, how can you construct a stable state of quantum equilibrium? Because standard quantum field theory in curved space-time usually assumes that space-time is globally hyperbolic. I mean, I think people don't stress this enough, but maybe there's something that I don't understand, but you impose canonical commutation relations on a Cauchy surface. When you construct the expansion of your field operators, you expand them in terms of mode functions that are solutions of classical field equations with a well-posed initial value problem, which would break down if it's not globally hyperbolic. Now, there are some people have studied a bit, you know, quantum field theory in a non-globally hyperbolic space-time. There's someone called Yurtsever, I think in the 90s, had some papers about this. He's looking at algebraic quantum field theory for some special space-times. It seemed to me that it wasn't very, you know, there was sort of limited applicability, but there's something peculiar about it, that the quantum state that he defines, Yurtsever, maybe I should write down his name. The quantum state that he defines is not a state on a Cauchy surface. It's a state that in some sense associated with the entire space-time, with boundary conditions and singularities. And I couldn't see, you know, how could you even discuss conservation of the Born rule over time in such a formalism? It just doesn't seem clear to me. Now, perhaps these problems can be resolved. Maybe there is a way of doing it. Or perhaps they are hints that the Born rule can run into difficulties in a gravitational context, even at the level of a classical space-time background. Now, if this was correct, I made a speculative suggestion some years ago that perhaps Hawking radiation would actually violate the Born rule, because the formation and a complete evaporation of a black hole would upset the conservation, the stability of the Born rule, and perhaps Hawking radiation would actually violate the Born rule. Intriguing. While I was preparing this talk, I noticed that there's some work that I haven't really been following details of, but in the last few years, people studying black hole horizons and the firewall problem and all this stuff, there's a whole series of papers. There's one that intrigued me by Marolf and Polchinski, based on earlier work by others, I think, where they're talking about violations of the Born rule, but in a somewhat different sense. They're talking about them having to define operators that are state dependent. So you're changing the usual Born rule. And they were claiming that to understand black hole horizons properly, these violations have to be large. Probably hasn't really got anything, details, of course, completely different from what I'm doing. But still, I found it intriguing, some parallel there. Let me go quickly, just warm up argument.
You had something to your first.
Yes.
I mean, a sort of more ubiquitous situation where you have violations of strict global hyperbolicity is wherever the topology changes.
Right.
So
yes.
The black hole one is kind of
right.
Sort of an example of that. But you can
right.
have just frank changes of topology, of
yes.
spatial topology.
Right, yes.
And
yes. then... See, I find it...
Some of us has written a paper looking at quantum field theory in that situation.
And
well, I could say more about it, but there are changes. I mean,
of course, you could always argue that for this reason, topology doesn't change.
But what?
The other point of view could be that space-time, by some law of nature, has to be just the product of the real line with some fixed spatial topology.
Right. Yes, which is something that to me seems natural in a pilot wave context. But then.
So I could give arguments against it, but let's
yeah.
not.
So then, global hyperbolicity is just part of the basic structure of things. But anyway, this argument is not particularly, it's kind of a warm-up argument, getting you used to the idea that, look, maybe something could go wrong with gravity. Can I move on? So warm-up argument number two is just one slide. I have a lot about this in that paper in 2014. But something, there's this funny thing about de Broglie-Bohm theory that all the interesting things about it, nobody seems to notice, at least in my view. There's a funny bit thing here. Look, this law of motion, I've just written down for one particle. It becomes ill-defined at nodes. When the wave function vanishes, the phase becomes ill-defined. In fact, it tends to go to infinity as you approach a node. There are singularities. The pilot wave, it's a bit like, Newton's laws with point particles moving under gravity. If the particles are on top of each other, the forces diverge. It actually has to be, if you're going to take this theory seriously, there has to be some sort of regularization of the dynamics at short distances. And I've discussed this. The only place I've ever seen this mentioned is in a footnote to one of Bell's papers back in the 80s. And basically, if you think of the velocity field as given by the current divided by psi squared, he's just in words, he says, you could regularize a theory by just smearing out the current and psi squared with a very narrow Gaussian.
In fact, that's usually the argument I have, a question I have about.
Good.
This one does that. It means that this theory is not complete.
Exactly.
We have many instances where anytime you have a Reinhold-Bohm phases, you're going to have nodes.
Ah, well, hang on.
Which are pinched.
There's another.
You have non-trivial.
Yes. Well, look, there's another.
Non-trivial interference pattern. You have these.
Yes. There's another. Look, there's
it looks like.
There's another thing. There's another thing that a lot of people don't realize is that a generic wave function has nodes. Let's say I'm just in two dimensions, okay, and at some fixed time t. Okay, this is equivalent to. Sorry, two equations. Okay. Each of these equations, so I'm in two dimensions, each of these equations defines a line. This will define a line. In general, the lines will cross.
Mm-hmm.
You have nodes. A generic wave function has nodes.
Yeah.
And so at these points, grad S usually diverges. Now the theory is incomplete. It's just like, you know, general relativity has singularities. If I have Newtonian mechanics of mass points moving under an inverse square law of gravity, you know, if the mass points actually sit on top of each other, it diverges, it's similar. The theory predicts its own breakdown. Nobody ever talks about this. I've written about this, and just a simple point I've made is that the regularization, if the regularization is time dependent, I mean, basically what you do is you can this grad S over M, so the velocity field is grad S over M, is equal to the quantum current over psi squared. And what you can do, you can replace this with a small Gaussian. Maybe I've written it as a delta function because I'm going to take the limit. So I'm smearing the top and the bottom with a very narrow Gaussian. And this is a narrow Gaussian with width A, which as it goes to zero, you recover the original theory. Now, this is actually what Bell suggested in the footnote to his paper. What happens is that the equilibrium distribution becomes the smeared. So you've got a smeared psi squared distribution. So in other words, you imagine that your usual psi squared, if this is your usual psi squared, what you've done is you're just averaging psi squared over a small interval with a little Gaussian, and you're saying that is actually, it's a sort of coarse-grained psi squared, if you like. So it's never zero, and you remove the singularities. It's just a simple, trivial way of removing singularities. And what happens is that this becomes the new equilibrium distribution. The new equilibrium distribution, okay? It's a simple little thing. But now what I discuss in that paper in 2014 is that, look, this smearing function, if it's time dependent, then the Born rule becomes unstable. An initial Born rule distribution can evolve to a final non-Born rule distribution. Now, this construction is all pretty arbitrary. There's nothing particularly compelling about it. For the purposes of this talk, what it tells you is, look, in pilot wave theory, I can easily construct a theory in which I remove the singularities and in which at very short distances, the Born rule would be unstable. And I can make these effects as small as I like by making this width of the smearing Gaussian arbitrarily small. Okay, so it's straightforward to construct a theory in which at very short distances you have an instability of the Born rule. So, but unfortunately, this model, you know, it's just sort of arbitrary. There's nothing compelling about it.
But the presence of these nodes, in fact, it's somehow the essence of quantum mechanics, because this is the fluxons. These nodes are the place where the phases wrap up to 2 pi and they're visible. So this is the reason why quantum mechanics leads to quantification. So in some sense, when you ignore the presence of these nodes,
right. So let me
be quantum mechanics.
Okay. So let me just clarify one thing. What so, we've done here, let me just so clarify one completed. Thing, is that we're not touching the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation is exactly the same
outside.
In this regularization, the Schrödinger equation, the wave function is there exactly the same. It's the expression for the de Broglie velocity field that is being regularized, that's all. Okay, the Schrödinger equation is untouched, so you know that's a good point.
We agree that Bohm theory therefore is incomplete. If you don't attach additional degrees of freedom, hidden variables, to the location and the property of these nodes, then You don't.
Well, hang on. The information about the nodes is all contained in the wave function and in the Schrödinger equation.
Yeah, but that Bohm theory is. I know, in Schrödinger it's fine. I'm just saying in the.
But the guidance equation diverges at nodes and it needs to be regularized. And I think actually there's a whole room. I mean, it's something I discussed in that paper. I think there's room for a whole research project that I've been starting and I just haven't had time to develop very far. In looking for new physics at nodes. In fact, my hope was to talk about this at the colloquium on Tuesday, but somehow preparing three talks for one week is just a bit too much. But maybe next time I'll give a talk about this stuff. But let me get on, if I can, where am I? It's already 3:10. I'm now going to get on to the things I really want to talk about, which is quantum equilibrium and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So Wheeler-DeWitt equation comes from quantizing classical general relativity, and, you know, canonically, what is the result that you get, that most people agree on is the result, is that you have a wave functional for a three metric. This wave functional, there's no time parameter here, so it's a functional of a three metric. Because of, you know, coordinate invariance or diffeomorphism invariance, however you want to put it, there's a condition here on the wave functional that basically says that, look, the wave functional is not really a function of the GIJ, it's a function of GIJ modulo coordinate transformations on free space. So it's a function on superspace, the space of three geometries. But now the thing of it, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, this is the famous Wheeler-DeWitt equation. It looks a bit like a Schrödinger equation, except you would think that on the other side there should be I d psi dt, but there isn't. Okay, it's a seemingly timeless theory. It is usually assumed that conventional quantum mechanics with the Born rule still applies somehow. But the physical interpretation remains controversial, in particular the problem of time, which I'll just sketch. The problem of time could be put like this. How can we recover an approximate time-dependent Schrödinger equation and time-dependent probabilities, for example, in the limit of a classical background, from an underlying theory with no time? You know, let's say I have a scalar field in space-time, and I've quantized the scalar field, I've quantized this gravitational field. There should be some limit in which I have, you know, your ordinary quantum field theory with probabilities evolving on a background space-time. How do you derive that when the fundamental theory has no time? So, some people, such as myself, have thought that there should be some preferred time parameter, that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is wrong. You need more like a Schrödinger-like equation with an I d psi by dt. Lee, I think, has also at least flirted with this idea, as have a number of others. I think Carol Kukash back in the 80s was saying things like this. There's a long history of this. Then there are others who say, no, you just have to accept that there's no time. Fundamentally, the fundamental description of physics, there's no such thing as time. For example, Ravelli, Barber. It seems to me this was DeWitt's view in 1967, looking at his big paper on quantum gravity in Phys Rev 1967. It seems to be what he was saying. So that time is just some emergent concept somehow. Now, there's an ongoing controversy since the 60s. You know, there may be something, no, it's not controversial, it's solved by this, this, and this. Well, look, a recent book came out by Edward Anderson in Cambridge. It's called The Problem of Time, published by Springer. It's 920 pages. I bought it on Amazon, and then I somehow regretted it when it arrived. This big it's a monstrosity of a book that just goes through all the different possible approaches. The reason I mention it is to say that, look, if this problem has been solved, why are people still publishing books like this? Why? I mean, it seems to me that, look, different people have strong opinions about this, but it is still unresolved. Why is it unresolved? Well, maybe because something is wrong. When I say something is wrong, I mean physically, not just mathematically. So what might be wrong? All right, so the key question of interest, in quantum gravity, can we establish the existence of a quantum equilibrium state without recourse to a time-dependent Schrödinger equation and an associated conserved probability current? Okay, remember, you know, when I have my nice time-dependent Schrödinger equation, okay, I can derive the following. Okay, this, as I mentioned, so this is, let me write it, this is on a general configuration space. If the Hamiltonian is given by a differential operator, at least, you can always find such a current as a conserved current and density. And then, of course, I can define a de Broglie velocity that's just J over psi squared. this construction will always work, but it, you know, it's predicated on having a time-dependent Schrödinger equation, well, with a conserved current. What if I don't have such an equation? So, all right, so let's have a look at pilot wave theory and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. For many years, I thought that, look, the pilot wave theory of quantum gravity should involve a time-dependent Schrödinger equation. In fact, I've still been doing some work on that, most recently with my former student, Philip Rosa, where we were looking at York time as a preferred time parameter. But I've become more interested that, you know, that maybe I was wrong. Maybe this, I used to think that this kind of theory was just wrong. But I'm sort of warming to the idea that actually maybe this is right, but we're just not thinking about it in the right way. So here is just formally, if I have the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, I've got my time-independent, just timeless wave functional, that you can write down an equation of motion for the three metric, which looks like this. This is a de Broglie-type equation of motion. Instead of mass times velocity is gradient of phase, you've got the velocity, or if you like, the time rate of change of the three metric, is given by, it's basically proportional to the functional derivative of the phase of the wave functional with respect to the metric. This is GIJ, this is something called the DeWitt superspace metric. It's just given in terms of the three metric. You can motivate this just canonically. So if you look at the canonical, the classical canonical general relativity in Hamiltonian form, the momentum conjugate to the canonical momentum conjugate to the three metric is Pij. And if you look at the relationship between Pij and G dot, okay, this equation is equivalent to writing this, which is just de Broglie, it's just comparable to saying P is the gradient of phase for one particle. It's basically the same thing. It's just the gradient of the phase of the wave functional on superspace, okay? So the analog, so the de Broglie, this is a de Broglie equation of motion. Now, the way it's motivated here is not from a current, because there's no, conserved current here. You can motivate it just from this, the canonical relation between momentum and velocity, okay? So you can motivate this. So you can write down these equations, and a number of people, Nelson Pinto Neto in particular in Rio, for many years has studied this system. Here you have, I'm going to say a fundamental dynamics with time t, and you may say, hang on, I thought you said there's no time. So here, the interpretation becomes a bit murky. But let's say you write down these equations. You say, I have an equation of motion for the three metric with respect to a time parameter. I have these arbitrary laps and shift functions, and I have the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for psi. My view used to be that surely this is not consistent because the theory is non-local. Time evolution of a three metric here will depend in general on what's happening over here. You have to have a preferred slicing, but here you've got arbitrary laps and shift functions. I always thought, look, this is just a non-starter. But it's interesting, there's a paper by Pinto Neto and Santini from 2002 where they discuss the following problem. They ask, is this dynamic well posed in the following sense? That if I start with a certain laps and shift function and I evolve and generate a four geometry, if I start with a different laps and shift function and evolve, do I get the same four geometry? And they claim that you do.
Classically, no, or quantum mechanics.
This is in de Broglie-Bohm. So here, the way they actually discuss this is they write it in terms of Hamiltonian mechanics, but with an extra what is in effect a quantum potential. So it is the de Broglie-Bohm. It's the de Broglie-Bohm version. I mean, so this was discussed. This problem was discussed by Teitelbaum in the 70s. Classically, they redo the same analysis but in de Broglie-Bohm, and they claim that you get the same four geometry except the algebra of constraints. So there's this Dirac-Teitelbaum algebra, which has to be satisfied in order to prove that you've got the same four geometry. They have a closed algebra of constraints, but it's slightly different from the usual one. And they claim that this is related to a breaking of local Lorentz invariants, that you still have a preferred foliation coming out of this. I don't feel I understand physically how this works, how this claim here is consistent with non-locality. You know, I mean, basically, I look at the mathematics, it seems all right, but I don't feel I understand it physically, so I'm suspicious. Okay? I'm suspicious of this. But let's take it that maybe this is correct. Maybe this is correct. If,
as you just pointed out, psi is not a function of t. So which psi are you supposed to be using at any given t? Is it always the same?
Oh, yes. No, yeah, no. So psi is just fixed.
So psi doesn't evolve.
No, psi does not evolve.
For every time t in that equation.
That is, oh, yes. Psi does not evolve. No, exactly. Psi does not evolve. Psi is just, you know, for any given solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, they claim you can generate a unique four geometry. I'm suspicious of this, but, you know, but as I said, because for physical reasons, but I don't quite, I've discussed it with Nelson. I mean, he's an excellent physicist. I just feel a bit uneasy. But let's just take it that maybe this is correct. Even so, and Nelson agrees with this, even if this is true, a problem remains. How do you connect the dynamics of single system? This is a dynamics of single free geometries. How do you connect it to a theory of a quantum equilibrium ensemble? Okay. So, because, as I've said over and over, you know, certainly in pilot wave theory, I think is the clearest way of looking at this, the De Broglie equation of motion, you need a velocity field in configuration space, which is a ratio of an equilibrium probability current and equilibrium probability density. There are no such quantities associated with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So what
so
do you...
There's no notion of a probability.
No. No notion of a conserved positive definite probability with the current. Okay. So common attempts to construct a time-dependent quantum probability density in quantum gravity. So very, you know, hand-wavingly, well, a common strategy is that you extract an effective time variable from the three metric. For instance, you know, the scale factor of an expanding universe. This sort of works in some domain, but often you... Ah, okay, and then, of course, so what you do, the wave functional and three metrics effectively becomes of the schematic form like this. You've extracted part of the three metric to play the role of time, and the remaining metric variables are the metric that's evolving in time somehow. Now, you know, the kind of problems you get, well, if, for instance, if A is your time variable, well, if the if you have a closed universe that expands and then recontracts, and it looks as if time suddenly go backwards, and you get these kinds of problems. And you know, it seems over decades people have gone over these things. My impression is that no matter how you do this, you always run into some trouble somewhere. There's no generally well-behaved equilibrium current or time-dependent density for these reduced metric degrees of freedom. So what you can do, there is an approximate Schrödinger regime where in some circumstances, and I'm going to discuss how this is done, you can derive an approximate Schrödinger-like equation with an effective Hamiltonian. This is only an approximation. And once you have that, then you can do the usual business. There's an associated continuity equation. I can define a De Broglie velocity field. I can consider the distribution of an arbitrary probability. And I can again do the equilibrium theorem that P is psi squared is conserved in time. But the big question is, what happens outside of the Schrödinger regime? And now finally, at the late time of 3:20-something, I'm getting into the core of this talk. So, as I said, don't worry, I'm leaving at the end of the week. So. All right, okay. What happens outside of the Schrödinger regime? Here is my proposal. Okay, it's a speculation, which I'm going to back up with some kind of evidence. But anyway, what happens outside of the Schrödinger regime? My proposal is that in quantum gravity, there is no quantum equilibrium state outside of the Schrödinger regime. In general, there is no Born rule in quantum gravity. Probabilities P are in principle arbitrary and need have no connection with psi. That's actually also true in De Broglie-Bohm, even without gravity, as I've been discussing the last couple of seminars. But what's new here is that the suggestion is that this is in quantum gravity, there is no stable equilibrium state for P. There's no stable equilibrium state. So that means that P will not relax to equilibrium because there is no equilibrium state to relax to, and that the equilibrium Born rule is applicable only in the approximate Schrödinger regime. Now.
So then you still have you might think that you still have an ensemble, but there's only one universe. So what is your
okay. ensemble? So I'm thinking, so here I'm allowing myself to think about a theoretical ensemble, which you could think about as, you know, different approximately independent regions of the universe. You could think about it as some tool that you use to think about probabilities, subjective best guesses. I'm not fixed on what...
You might decide not to think about it.
Or you might decide not to think about it. But I'm thinking that there is a theoretical ensemble with a probability distribution P. I mean, I might just be describing the gravitational dynamics of some region where, you know, quantum gravity effects are important, and outside of this region, things are essentially classical. But anyway, but you know, that's a fair query. But I'm my P is the probability distribution for a theoretical ensemble. Interpret that as you will. Now, here's a possible way of implementing that. If Nelson in Rio is right that this is a consistent dynamics of individual systems, okay, this is just a deterministic dynamics of individual systems, and I take this to be the law of motion for each three geometry, then an arbitrary ensemble with distribution P will evolve by construction by this continuity equation. But note now there's no corresponding continuity equation for psi squared. In fact, psi squared is just static. And the suggestion is, well, that this defines, if Nelson is right, this will define a consistent dynamics of general ensembles. And my proposal is, or suggestion, this has no stable equilibrium state. There's nothing in particular that an arbitrary P would relax to. Okay, this is just an evolving ensemble. There is no stable equilibrium state. So the kind of thing, if the above is true, this is the kind of thing that you would expect. That look, if it's true in the deep quantum gravity regime, there is no stable equilibrium state. In the Schrödinger regime, you get this nice psi squared that's conserved in time and that's stable equilibrium. In the intermediate regime, you would expect there to be a regime where there are quantum gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation such that the Born rule is unstable. And I'm going to discuss such corrections.
Just one quick question. In the previous slide, so you still have, again, the same question, you still have n, but what is the status of n there? Is it still any n, but this t for which...
Right. So according to the theorem, according to Pinto, Neto, and Santini, you know, the n and the ni, they're arbitrary lapse and shift functions.
Okay. So this t is for any time function?
Yes. And if I evolve this equation to generate a four geometry, their claim is that if I then rerun it with a different lapse and shift function, I get the same four geometry. Now, as I said, I'm not sure, I don't feel I understand physically how this works.
But my question is about this next equation.
Yes.
It should be valid for any of these t.
You're saying here?
Yeah.
Yes. This would be valid for any of these t. Yes. So, you know, what I'm doing here, I'm being, you know, a little bit, you know, from the point of view of a foundations person, a little bit naughty. I'm writing down equations, and I'm not sure I fully understand the physics of how this works. Because I said, you know, Nelson, Pintonet, and Santini, as I said, they do an analysis of this equation that looks like the classical analysis that Teitelboim did in the 70s with the Dirac Teitelboim algebra of constraints and showing this consistency, except you have this extra quantum potential density in there in the Hamiltonian. And it seems to get a closed algebra of constraints, but just looks a bit different from the classical one. And it sort of seems to make sense. But as I said, physically, I feel there's something I don't quite understand. So you know, I have a question mark over all of this.
But Anthony, if you choose the time arbitrarily by choosing your lapse and shift, is there any equation that tells you that the total probabilities add up to one?
So this, So this here, by construction here, you know, P is, you know, if I assume that this current vanishes at infinity, I just integrate this over configuration space, and it tells you that the norm, that the integral of P over the whole configuration space is constant. Okay, this is just by construction. Okay, this is just a continuity equation. This is just saying that dp by dt plus the divergence of p is zero, whether this is just a divergence in superspace. Okay? So if j vanishes at infinity, I can integrate this and just the usual but let me move on because I'm a bit behind here. I want to talk about that if this is true. Okay, it's leading me to expect that you would expect there to be an intermediate regime where quantum gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation make the Born rule unstable. And I'm going to connect this with work that Klaus Kiefer has been doing for a long time. So now the kind of thing I'm thinking is, imagine you have an initial state where quantum gravity is negligible, and I've got a Schrödinger regime, I've got a time function, I've got a time-dependent Schrödinger equation, and then it hits a quantum gravity regime, and then it emerges into a Schrödinger regime. This, something like this could happen if I have a universe that bounces, a contracting universe that bounces. In the bounce, quantum gravity is important, then it expands again. You would expect that as you come out here, that you would be out of the initial quantum equilibrium would evolve to a quantum non-equilibrium. And you may ask, well, how is this going to happen? All right. So now, let me talk about Klaus Kiefer's work. Starting in 1991, he derived what he calls gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation. Typically, the kind of system he looks at is he has a matter field, as well as the three geometry, they're quantized. I have a Wheeler-DeWitt type equation for the wave functional, which again is timeless, but it's now a functional of Gij and of the matter field. And he does a Born-Oppenheimer expansion of the wave functional in powers of the square of the Planck mass, this kind of thing. And what he does, he's got many papers about this, is that the lowest order S obeys a background classical Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which he uses to define a time that's often called the WKB time. I think it goes back to Say in the 80s, I think maybe first called it that. Basically, you're using this here, this piece is just the WKB or de Broglie-Bohm velocity generated by this lowest order S0. And you're using those trajectories to define an effective time parameter. So essentially what you're doing, this relation enables you to convert a displacement in configuration space into a displacement in a time parameter that you're defining by this method. Okay, now this is a method, if it seems a bit obscure to the foundations people, well it is, but it's a method that has been used for decades in this quantum gravity context. Quantum gravity people here would have seen this, you know, there's something that goes back decades, how to define an effective time parameter in this sort of regime. But now you go to the next order. So now you've got this sort of background three metric and an effective time parameter. You go to the next order, and what you have defined is an effective matter. Here I'm just telling you what Kiefer's been, collaborators have been doing for decades. You define an effective matter wave functional for the scalar field alone, evolving on a background classical space-time. And you derive a corrected Schrödinger equation where this is the matter Hamiltonian, i.e. the Hamiltonian for the scalar field, call it matter Hamiltonian, we mean the Hamiltonian of the scalar field. And there are corrections here. And generally, you find that there's a small correction that's Hermitian, and then there is an even smaller correction that is non-Hermitian. Now, of course, what does that mean? It means it violates unitarity, i.e. it breaks the conservation of the Born rule. Now, similar calculations have been done by Kiefer and collaborators for many superspace models. I'm going to give you an example with showing you exactly what these look like, but just schematically, you get a Schrödinger-like equation, you have a mini superspace model. I have, a quantized scalar field evolving on a Friedmann-Lemaître background. So the gravitational field is just a homogeneous expanding universe. And for that case, there's mini superspace as far as the gravitational variables are concerned. But here you have a scalar field. Here is the field Hamiltonian. The corrected Schrödinger equation he obtains, there's a small Hermitian term, and there's an even smaller non-Hermitian term. Now, if you want to look at here, this paper by Kiefer and Kramer was in PRL in 2012, where they discuss the effect of this term on the CMB. And they're hoping to see some effect of this in the CMB, and they show that there are some small effects at large scales. But they ignore this term, which is even smaller, and by the way, non-Hermitian, so problematic to discuss in conventional quantum mechanics. Now, question, not these non-Hermitian corrections, are they fact or artifact? It's unclear. You can mathematically eliminate them by redefining the wave function. But this seems a bit artificial. So as Beeny et al, I mean, I think it's this second paper in 2013, where they study this effect on the CMB spectrum, they discuss this, and they themselves say, look, you can do this, but it's unclear which is the true physical wave function. I've discussed this with Klaus Kiefer, and he told me, you know, he still feels that these non-Hermitian corrections are there somehow. As I was preparing this, polishing this talk late last night, I won't say how late it was, because I think even the old Lucian would be shocked if he knew how late I was working last night. I was just looking out, hang on, I thought, let me just check something, one of Kiefer's papers. Literally 1 week ago, they've put out a new paper, another attempt to eliminate these terms by a new kind of Born-Oppenheimer expansion with some funny gauge symmetry, which I didn't really understand. What I can say is that looking at the paper briefly, they're not saying, actually we found a mistake, you know, and there's no, they're sort of proposing a new way of doing it that seems, I can't really comment because I haven't studied it enough, but they've made another attempt to eliminate these terms. But now, here's a situation where, of course, in conventional quantum mechanics, you have non-Hermitian terms, you say, well, they can't be there, there must be something wrong. But in the context of my proposal, actually, maybe they are there, and they're a signature of the breakdown of the stability of the Born rule. And then, in fact, this can be described easily by pilot wave dynamics. So let me, you know, go super quickly. Pilot wave theory with a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. Here I can always split any operator into a Hermitian and anti-Hermitian part. So here H1 and H2 are both Hermitian. And I can write down a Schrödinger-like equation. And if you try to derive a continuity equation, you get this. You get here, the current here is the standard current associated with the Hermitian part, and you get a source term that is associated with the non-Hermitian term that looks like this, is an effective source term. And if you integrate this over configuration space and assume this current vanishes at infinity, you can easily show that the time derivative of the norm, the usual Born rule norm, the time derivative is not zero. Is not zero. As you say, so you know, unitarity is violated. This is just, you know, what we already know about, nothing to do with pilot wave theory. But now you can make a pilot wave theory by defining the de Broglie velocity field to be just the standard de Broglie velocity field that's associated with the Hermitian part. So this is the current associated with the Hermitian part. And for an ensemble, by definition, if this is the velocity field, rho will satisfy this continuity equation, and which is different from the continuity equation for psi squared that has a source term. This defines a pilot wave theory with an unstable Born rule, because psi squared satisfies this, so what you have, your actual density satisfies this continuity equation. Psi squared satisfies a continuity equation with a source term. The ratio of rho to psi squared is not conserved along trajectories. So what you have is that if you take this dynamics, this pilot wave dynamics with a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian, if rho is psi squared initially, generally it will not be psi squared later on. Now, just very briefly, you can define a time scale over which this non-equilibrium is generated. If you're close to equilibrium, the time scale is just 1 over 2 times the modulus of the expectation value of this non-Hermitian term. Well, actually, H2 is Hermitian, but the contribution to the Hamiltonian is I times that. Anyway, you get the same time scale if you consider the rate of change of the H function. Maybe I should skip over this because I'm really out of time, but I still have quite a bit to say. If you consider the time rate of change of this relative entropy of rho and psi squared, you know, the time scale, you get the same time scale. Okay, so this is our time scale for the generation of quantum non-equilibrium. Now let me apply this to, and we want an example. Let's have a look at an example. Let's look at a scalar field mode during inflation. We want to estimate this time scale. What we're going to do is we're going to take the expectation value in the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So what Kiefer and collaborators do is they have, when they're discussing corrections to the CMB, they have, an inflaton field on an expanding background, and you have here, psi zero is your Bunch-Davies vacuum. In other words, that's the wave function when there are no gravitational corrections. They derive a Schrödinger equation. Here is the corrected wave function, including quantum gravitational corrections. This Schrödinger-like equation I've taken from their paper in PRL 2012. So you have here is the standard Hamiltonian for a single mode. It's like a harmonic oscillator. The correction terms depend on the zeroth order uncorrected wave function, and they depend on this Hamiltonian, and there's the Planck mass squared coming in here. And notice, these terms are multiplicative. This is a function. I let this operator squared act on the uncorrected wave function, so I get a function, not an operator. Similarly here, these terms are Hermitian. This term is non-Hermitian. And and what I'm doing, of course, sorry, I'm in a hurry now, but I'm looking at a single mode of the scalar field. So in Fourier space, I'm using its real and imaginary parts as the degrees of freedom. So these Qs are the real and imaginary parts of the Fourier component of the scalar field. So here is the equation that Kiefer and these are supposed to be quantum gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation for a single mode of a scalar field on expanding space. One correction is real, one is imaginary. And so in our notation, we have H1 is this, and H2, the interesting part that they ignore. Okay, they just study this term and the effect on the CMB. They ignore this term. But let's now look at this term. Of course, the Bunch-Davies vacuum wave function just satisfies the uncorrected Schrödinger equation. All right, we want to estimate.
Anthony, just give us how many more slides you have.
I think I have about maybe 7. I'll be quick.
Yeah.
I'll be really quick. Okay, so what we do here is to estimate the time scale. This time scale, basically, it's just a matter of estimating this, of calculating this expectation value. And you can do it if you know the Bunch-Davies wave function. You can calculate this expectation value. You get this result, where I've defined x is essentially the ratio of the physical wavelength to the Hubble radius. This is my rough estimate for the time scale for the gravitational production of quantum non-equilibrium during an inflationary phase. To get a sense of order of magnitude, let's take some sort of number that people often use just for illustration. Let's take the energy scale of inflation to be 10 to the minus 3 of the Planck scale. And let's consider some small range of this parameter x around x is 1. So the physical wavelength is not too close to the Planck length where the calculation would be valid. And I'm interested in this region where I'm just exiting the Hubble radius. So for x of order 1, and if I take A to be of order the Hubble radius, this is just a very hand-waving estimate, that the time scale is of order 10 to the 9 Planck times. Let's compare that to the time the mode spends in this regime. This is only a fraction. It spends a fraction of order 10 to the minus 6 of this time scale. So in other words, I've got a certain time scale for the generation of quantum non-equilibrium. The interval during which it should be effective is only 10 to the minus 6 of that time scale. So you expect that the effects will be very small. Okay. Now, where could these effects be important? There's a whole literature about trans-Planckian modes and inflation. Starting with Brandenberger and Martin, 2001, they argue that trans-Planckian field modes are likely to contribute to the CMB spectrum. What's a trans-Planckian mode? It's a mode whose physical wavelength started out smaller than the Planck length, and then grows during inflation and ends up contributing to the spectrum. Now, if this is true, you can use inflation potentially to probe physics at the Planck scale. There's a nice review of this by Brandenburg and Martin. So our proposal suggests that the field modes, when they exit the Planck radius, they will be in a state of quantum non-equilibrium owing to these quantum gravitational effects. So clearly, we need more detailed predictions. So far, I've just got a very crude estimate for the time scale over which non-equilibrium could be generated. My guess is that probably the effects are going to be too small to be observed, but nevertheless, in principle, could be there. I have two more slides. Laboratory systems. What about something in the lab? If there's anything in what I've been saying, you would expect that quantum non-equilibrium is being continually generated at the Planck scale. Right here, right now, you know, in my fingernail. There you go, it's being generated. However, from what I've discussed in the previous, say, for instance, yesterday, and you might think that, well, the effect will be very small, but maybe over a very long time. Millions of years, billions of years, it could maybe build up and become significant. However, this would be counteracted by the natural relaxation process that occurs when a system is in a superposition. If I have an atom that's in a superposition of energy states, if this non-equilibrium gradually builds up from the Planck scale, it's going to relax away by the kind of process that I showed you yesterday. If I have, you know, superposition of energy states. So if the atom has interacted with other things in a superposition, any non-equilibrium generated by from the Planck scale would just relax away. Here's a speculative prediction. If a laboratory system is sufficiently isolated and kept in an energy eigenstate, in an energy eigenstate, you don't get the relaxation process because the velocity field is too simple. If it's kept in an energy eigenstate for a very long time, the prediction is it will eventually evolve significantly away from quantum equilibrium and violate the Born rule. Now, you might say, how are you going to keep it sufficiently isolated? Here's something to note. Small perturbations do not cause relaxation. I've showed this in a paper. If I have a superposition of energy states where I have, you know, ground state, excited state, this excited state, and the coefficients, you know, 1 over root 3, 1 over whatever, then the system relaxes rapidly. If I have a superposition of a ground state plus a coefficient 0.001 of an excited state plus 0.002 of an excited state, it doesn't relax. The trajectories are just slightly perturbed and move around in a confined region. They don't explore the distribution. So small perturbations do not cause relaxation. So I think that isolating the system will not be a problem. But waiting for long enough may well be, because the time scale, you know, I don't know what the time is. If you ask me, if I have a hydrogen atom isolated in the box, how long will it take for the non-equilibrium to build up to a point where you could see it? I don't know. Is it 1,000 years? Is it 1,000 billion years? I have to work on that. But still, this is something that, you know, you might expect if there's something in this. My final slide, let me just make a few comments. So one thing I'd like to point out, I think the general idea that there's no quantum equilibrium state in quantum gravity is you know, it has a certain attraction to it, independent of Kiefer et al.'s result. I mean, they have these results that the gravitational corrections to the Schrödinger equation can be non-Hermitian. Maybe they are spurious. Maybe they are spurious, but I think there might still be something in this idea, and that we should investigate the borderline between the Schrödinger and non-Schrödinger regimes. And the result might be that we'll find that gravitation makes quantum equilibrium unstable. And if this is true, it would mean that, you know, for the past half a century, assuming the Born rule in quantum gravity may have been a long-standing mistake. So that is it. I've gone way over time, and thank you.
Wouldn't it be more correct to say that assuming the Born rule in quantum gravity was never done? Because, I mean, what is the Born rule in
right.
quantum gravity? You pointed that out already.
Good. Good. No, that's a fair. So I think this is what happens when you prepare a talk at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning. This should read, attempting to assume the Born rule in quantum gravity, maybe. No, absolutely right. I agree completely. It should be attempting. They attempt to assume the Born rule.
Right.
Question about the regularization stuff. So if I imagined, so you said, you know, the theory kind of already prescribed where it would break down.
Yeah.
And that's true if you assume that P deviates from psi squared. Of course, if probability distribution goes to zero at the nodes, then you never have a problem. So it's under non-equilibrium that you predict some sort of...
I think I may have said something.
Where are the nodes?
No,
this
hang on.
He has to tell you where the nodes are. And what's
no,
the,
sorry, I think maybe I didn't explain it properly. Hang on, I'm a bit confused by what you said. Let me just...
Say it again, just so that we're on the same page.
Okay.
So what I'm claiming is that if we take the usual approach to Bohmian mechanics, which says that the probability distribution from which the Bohmian configurations are sampled is not contingent, but fixed to be psi squared as a necessary thing.
Okay.
Say we take that point of view, which is not your point of view.
Right. Okay.
But then the fact that the gradient of the phase is not well-defined at the nodes doesn't hurt you, because if you ask what measure of the trajectories lie at those points, answer, measure zero. So I never need to work out the velocity of any particle at a node, because the probability distribution is under zero.
Okay.
But you need to tell me where the nodes are.
Yeah, well, that's the wave function. The wave function tells you where the nodes are.
Yeah, but then you go back, go back outside. Either you have, you go back outside Bohm. I'm saying, you know.
No, you keep saying that. Bohm includes the Schrodinger equation.
Oh, if you have a Schrodinger equation, then what's new? I mean,
either
you try to replace that by a classical description, and then this classical description...
Let me have this conversation with Anthony, and then you can have your conversation. But I don't think what you're talking about has anything to do with what I'm worried about. So my question is just that if we do take this non-equilibrium distribution over the particle configuration, then I see that there's a problem, because now there's some non-zero measure at the nodes. So I need to know what the velocity of a particle that lands at a node would be.
Okay. So can I just...
And that's why... Okay, so have I got it right in terms of your motivations?
So not really, because... you know, let's say in the two-dimensional example here. So, you know, you get points, you know, if you have a wave function in a two-dimensional box, you know, you will find there are some points where psi is zero, okay? These points are of measure zero with respect to the sort of standard, you know, dx, dy, Lebesgue measure.
Mm-hmm.
They're also of measure zero with respect to the psi squared measure. If I had any reasonable non-equilibrium probability distribution, they would also be of measure zero, except if I had a probability distribution that was, you know, delta function at these points, which I think is probably unphysical. Okay. So basically, with respect to any reasonable measure, these points of measure zero. And for that reason, most people just ignore this. They say, look, you know, it's like in, you know, if I've got the Newtonian mechanics of point particles moving under Newtonian gravity, you know, this problem affects only a set of points of measure zero. The particles are literally on top of each other, so I don't care about this. Now, this is fair enough in practice, okay? But to my mind, hang on a second. I mean, as Laurent has said,
you know, they're not points, right?
If this is the theory,
you could dimension one surface.
There are points in configuration space where the physics breaks down, the law of motion breaks down. It might be that you're never going to hit such a point, almost certainly. But you know, we're trying to understand the universe here. This is supposed to be. You know, we're saying here, you know, here's a configuration space. If the particle starts here, I have an equation of motion, I can predict where it goes. This space contains isolated points where the equation of motion just breaks down. That is, surely, this is not, you know, as Laurent mentioned, at least in principle, it's not a complete theory. There's something wrong. But most people just ignore this. And you know, as I mentioned, for some reason, it's like most people ignore non-equilibrium. So you know, to me, there are two things in de Broglie-Bohm that are crying out to you that there is new physics to explore. One is that you can have non-equilibrium, and one is that the equations of motion break down at nodes. There must be some new physics at nodes. And of course, the only person who talks about this stuff is me, so maybe I'm just a crackpot. But to my mind, you know, these are the interesting things about de Broglie. So, but you know, as I said, any reasonable probability measure, these points are of measure zero. So in practice, you're not gonna worry about them. But it's a point of principle.
Okay. So they're not, sorry, they're not points.
It's
a condition. No, but these are domain zero. These are domain rules. I mean,
yeah, sorry, okay.
So,
so listen, yeah. Sorry, they're of dimension.
In configuration space.
They're of dimension n minus 2.
No, it's one condition.
If you're in a two-dimensional configuration space, they're points. If you're in three-dimensional space, they're lines.
Configuration space of
four-dimensional,
they're
surfaces.
Which are, can be macroscopic or object. As your observables are concerned.
That's right.
For purposes of this discussion, that has the same status because it's still a set of measure zero.
Right, still, it's still measured.
Does that change any of the
conversation? It depends from
So one nice example, for instance, a nice example is the hydrogen atom.
Way too naive.
If I have a hydrogen atom, it's in an energy eigenstate of non-zero angular momentum, okay? And so here's the z-axis. Particle trajectory is, given by the gradient phase, do this. The velocity diverges all along the z-axis. The z-axis is a node. It's a line.
Not important for what we're discussing, and I agree with what you said that if you worry just about, say you imagine that the original Bohmian position is sampled not from some uniform distribution, but something that's a bunch of delta functions or whatever, then you'll never hit one of these points in practice.
Right.
But as you say, you're worried about whether the physics is well defined at this point.
Right.
Here's the question.
Can I just add one little thing? Because I think one little thing is maybe important I didn't mention. Is that, look, if there's new physics at the node, then you would expect that there's probably new physics when you get very close to the node.
Good. So is there any evidence, if I imagine studying the relaxation of non-equilibrium in the following manner, rather than take an arbitrary distribution, take a side squared distribution, and in a very small region, perturb it. So add a little epsilon difference relative to psi squared.
Are you saying change the wave function slightly?
Nope. Take capital P, the probability distribution of Bohmian positions.
Right.
Make it psi squared.
Plus epsilon
of a little Gaussian
bump
at this position. Right. So then you can study how that
relaxes.
It relaxes, and in general, for the cases you consider, I'm sure it'll smear out, it'll add some fine-grained structure, and eventually, on coarse-grained scales, it'll look. Now, if I take that blip and I put it closer and closer to the node, what happens? Do we expect that the equilibration process differs?
Because
if it was different near mode, then this whole business about the fact that the node is set of measures, it becomes irrelevant. Yeah. It says, look, the physics we predict near nodes changes. And it's pertinent to equilibration.
Right. So if you look at just at the unregularized theory, which is what we've done simulations with, the relaxation actually takes place particularly rapidly near nodes. Because what happens, the velocity field circulates rapidly around the nodes, and the nodes are moving. And the nodes behave, it's a bit like, you imagine P and psi squared are like two different liquids. And you've got these electric mixers. They're going and moving around and mixing. It's a little bit like that. The nodes actually play a role in generating relaxation. If you ask me what would happen if I take a regularized theory where the actual equilibrium distribution is this smeared psi squared, I've not done any studies of relaxation, but the expectation would be that, if this smearing thing is small, that the results are going to be arbitrarily close to what you usually get. And you would expect that if I start out of equilibrium, that it's going to relax to this smeared equilibrium state. That's the expectation, but nobody's actually studied it. Have I answered your question, or have I?
It hasn't been studied, has it?
No. So the relaxation, you can easily write down an H theorem that's similar to the H theorem, and make the same kind of argument. Actual numerical simulations in the regularized theory, nobody's done. If someone wants to get me a grant for a student to run some simulations, please email me. I've been looking forward to hear what Lee makes of this.
We were talking before, there are these quantum chemists.
Yeah.
Who simulate the Breuer-Bohm theory by taking a probability distribution, taking an ensemble of trajectories, and integrating it forward. And they don't seem to have a problem with nodes.
No.
Depends on the state. So the nodes appear when you have interference pattern, when you have quantum. I mean, if you take a state like the quantum state, if you take a semi-classical state, the nodes are going to be very sparse. If you take a truly quantum state with lots of interference, you have nodes everywhere. And these nodes, they are codimension 1, 2 surface,
N minus 2,
10 to the 30, they're huge. Yeah. And they have non-local effect. They interact, and they create filament, domain wall. I mean,
So we're talking a lot about the stuff about nodes. It was supposed to be sort of warm up. I'm really interested in what people think about the you know, this non-equality, this instability of the Born rule in quantum gravity. Can anyone attack me on that?
You're making. Go ahead.
Lee?
You go, Leo. Go after.
Okay, you're making. Let me put your point positively. A generic theory of quantum gravity has a problem with establishing what the norm is. The reason why we haven't had a Born rule in quantum gravity is that the Born rule has to represent the inner product of the physical Hilbert space, and it's very difficult to compute what the physical Hilbert space is or what its norm is. And that's a big issue in quantum gravity, and it's been a stumbling block for years and years and years. It's been a problem for loop quantum gravity. Now, you're saying let's take a de Broglie-Bohm version of quantum gravity. Then there is a probability distribution, which is the probability distribution that comes from the trajectories, the physical trajectories.
Yeah.
And you're saying you may be able to make sense of a quantum theory of gravity using the norm for the trajectories based on the additional structure that de Broglie-Bohm has. Yeah. Which can ignore the fact that we don't have a Born rule.
Right.
We don't have a physical inner product.
Right.
So that's putting the proposal. That's saying that the additional structure, the real trajectories, and their probability distribution may save the day for a quantum theory.
Right.
That's a big
thing. Does anyone have any feelings about, you know, these results of Kiefer, these corrections?
Conservation of the outer.
Sorry?
You're paying too much attention to them. You're...
Oh, really?
I think so.
I don't know. I mean, Lee, this is an argument. I think what you're saying, Kiefer, I relate it to another argument that Carlo is making, which is if you have a physical clock or Gambini, Poulin, which is if you have a physical clock and you use it, it's not exactly, and you measure time with respect to physical clock. Let's say time is relational for a moment.
Right. Okay.
Then the effective dynamics for that particular time is going to be non-unitary. That's another, so as you're saying, this is a very...
Okay. No, that's right. I'd actually forgot.
It's a physical system which is quantum to measure time because of the fluctuation. Time.
Actually, now I'd forgotten about that. Of course, Gambini and Poulin, in their approach too, there's an effective non-unitarity.
Yes.
So again,
it's like if you try to define and mine time out of the physical system, it becomes effective.
Right. Which I think they interpret as a sort of effective decoherence collapse process, which then becomes debatable. I mean, I guess so. There maybe one could suggest that hang on, maybe it's not really. Decoherence collapse. And so what it really is the Born rule breaking down. So, okay, no, thanks. I'd forgotten. You know, good.
So I think unless there is an external classical clock, I think it's. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it sounds as if you're sounding as I was expecting people to say, come on, this is all nonsense. But it sounds as if you think it's possible that the Born rule is unstable because of quantum gravitational effects.
The Born rule doesn't make sense in quantum gravity.
Doesn't make right. Okay. Sure. No, I mean, which is essentially, what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if that's true, you would expect there would be an intermediate regime between the non-Schrödinger and Schrödinger regime where you could write down a Schrödinger-like equation with corrections that violate the Born rule. That's what you would expect. And in fact, that's what then, surprise, hey, you look at Kiefer, and actually they've had just such terms, since the early 90s, and of course there's Gambini and Poulin as well. And so, normally people would try to make sense of such terms within standard quantum mechanics. And the point I'm making is essentially is that, well, actually maybe we should make sense of such terms in a different way by interpreting them as a breakdown of the Born rule in the kind of sense that I'm talking, breakdown of the stability of the Born rule in the sense that I've been describing.
Let me make some critical very comments please. At a very general level. First of all, there's the whole, I mean, you framed this in trying to approach the problem of time. Now, let me make two comments. First, in a positive way, I mean, I've thought for a long time I could give you some of the reasons. Quantum gravity cannot be unitary. It just cannot. And the reasons have to do, there are other reasons than what you're giving here, except they overlap in relation to the black hole evaporation.
Right.
Otherwise, they're having to do with fundamental discreteness and so on.
Right.
So if there's genuine non-unitarity in quantum gravity, then again, I don't know there won't be conservation of probability in the sense that you're expecting, or there won't be, what can I say? You won't be able to interpret something like a Born rule in terms of a pure state, a wave function.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair statement.
Right.
So I think there are many things that point to the same conclusion.
Right. Good.
Topology change is another one.
Yes.
However, in a more critical way, in general, it seems to me you framed everything in terms of the problem of time. The problem of time is a problem of canonical quantization, gravity.
Yes.
It's not, arguably, a problem of a path integral approach to gravity. So I think if you start thinking in terms of, I mean, this will not be the first time I've said this, but if you think in terms of a path integral, 90% of those problems of time go away, and the other 10% are soluble in principle.
Are you thinking
technical.
Euclidean?
No, I'm talking about Lorentzian path integral. So there is no problem of time because you're working with space-time, with space, right? And there's a whole formalism you can define, so what people with Jim and Murray call the coherence functional, closely related to what we call quantum measure.
In the Lorentzian case.
What does it mean there's no gauge? Who said there had to be gauge? Are you talking about a technical problem in defining path integral? Of course, there are technical problems, but we're not... Those are more or less decoupled from these kind of conceptual problems that you're raising here. There's technical problems in defining a path integral, even in continuum non-relativistic quantum mechanics. To my mind, those technical problems are alleviated by discreteness, which is the idea behind causal set. But there's no conceptual problem in talking about time, because you're dealing with space-time. It's just a trivial point. Some sense.
I can ask you more about that later. I don't know if it maybe, but maybe it's not the right time. But if you do think of this path, this decoherence, this
I'm not talking about decoherent histories. Talking about consistent history.
Okay.
I'm just talking about the path integral and the mathematical object, which is.
What are the boundary conditions you put on the path integral? Because there are issues of time which come from the fact that unless you're going to have histories that go from minus infinity to plus infinity and never have anything, never measure anything, and never determine the value of any quantity, there are interpretation problems with the path integral, and they are possibly related to the fact that the question about what time is and what the meaning of time.
Well, there are interpretational, I agree, even in ordinary, in all of quantum mechanics, there are interpretational issues.
No, but he's
that's right, and I think they're essentially the same interpretational issues.
No, but he's talking
about
there's
no problem in recovering time from a timeless framework.
Sure. This is a separate discussion. It's not maybe directly related to Anthony's discussion, so.
Maybe after, Raphael, it'd be interesting, we could maybe chat afterwards about, you say there are other reasons for expecting non-unitarity.
Yeah.
Be interested to hear.
That we agree on.
Oh, sorry?
That we agree on.
Right.
So maybe do you want to say something about what are your reasons for expecting non-unitarity?
Why are you saying that?
Sorry, what's the
question? Raphael or Leo?
Are you saying that quantum gravity needs to be
unitary? I'm not saying it needs to be unitary, but there are issues with unitarity due to the difficulty of determining what the physical inner product is.
Yeah, I mean, one question, the first simplest partial answer is, what do you mean by unitarity? If you say that quantum gravity is unitary, first you have to tell us what you mean by that.
Well, it
you're already
well, it, well, exactly.
At that stage.
No, I
mean, I have further reasons relating to causal sets.
Yeah,
and an underlying discrepancy.
No, yeah, yeah.
Which.
Absolutely.
Okay, but that's a weaker. That okay, but that's a weaker statement.
What's a weaker statement?
Where that. You know, so you just mean that by non-unitary, or you mean
you
something
mean
more.
What?
You just mean that there's no time, and then all you have is operator, Hilbert space, and scalar product, but you don't have.
No, I'm not saying.
What did you mean that when you said that quantum gravity?
You talking to me or
to you? You said it's obvious that quantum gravity means.
I didn't say it's obvious. I said there are many reasons to think that quantum gravity would not be unitary, and one the very first reason is to ask yourself what would you mean by unitarity of quantum gravity outside of an S matrix framework, which is one that's more or less obviously not applicable to cosmology. Despite what some people seem to think. But to me, it's obvious that it's not an appropriate framework for cosmology. If you go outside of that, what do you mean by unitary?
Let's say you mean, even in cosmology, that the Hilbert space.
There's
a conservation of Hilbert space between minus infinity and plus infinity. The conservation of Hilbert space.
Conservation in what? See,
no, between the initial.
But there are no initial and final. That's the whole.
But there's the past and the future.
Unless you have this particular way of gauge fixing.
No, the fact that there's
the
fact that there's no time doesn't means that you cannot assign a number to the time elapse. We cannot agree on a given number to the time elapse between two events. But we can agree that there is an event which is in the past and an event which is in the future.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, anyway, as I understand unitarity in quantum field theory, you have one way of phrasing it is that you would have Cauchy surfaces and you would have some effective evolution to take you from one Cauchy surface to another Cauchy surface, and you'd have a Hilbert space associated with each one, and you'd have a unitary map from one to the other. That you don't have those things, at least all of them, in quantum gravity. So I think it's very hard to get started to even know what you would mean by unitarity. The second question is, do you have Hamiltonian evolution? What is it that's responsible for unitarity in ordinary theories? Well, if you look into the formalism, it's Hamiltonian evolution. Right? I mean, one could argue other frameworks, bootstrap frameworks or whatever. You could try and build it in as a postulate. To my mind, those are limited to S matrix. As far as to my knowledge, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying is
it's
similar to the one.
If you have a fundamental discreteness, which involves time as well and not only space, then there cannot be a Hamiltonian. So you're already stuck for a formal underpinning of unitarity, right? You can try and get around it again if you have a kind of very nice lattice structure where there's a clear separation of time and space, and all you've done is you've made time discrete, then you can say, I just demand that there be some transfer matrix, some basically e to the I h delta t. I don't know what h is, but I know it is e to the I h delta t. Again, I think the kind of discreteness that is suitable for quantum gravity, that's strongly suggested by diffeomorphism invariance, local Lorentz invariance, is not of that nature. That would be, again, a kind of gauge fixing, a slicing. So there, again, I don't see even any foothold for
how to begin. What you're saying is a bit like the way I've put it, you know, in the Breuer-Bohm point of view. You say, well, if I have a Schrödinger-like equation for wave function, I can derive a continuity equation, and then I can talk about the conserved Born rule. But if I don't have, If I don't have such a starting point, how do I even begin?
Yeah, I think that's similar. Yeah.
Basically, the same, similar.
Time. Similar observation. And then there's another thing special to causal sets, which is that you have to look at the kind of superspace variables, you know, in the sense of street geometry. They're not natural. I mean, I won't elaborate on that. But there are the physical situations that people have often pointed to. Black hole evaporation that are quite consistent with that kind of expectation of non-unitarity. And I would add topology change. So I think on one hand there's strong formal reasons to not even be clear on what unitarity could mean or where it could come from. And then there are actual physical processes that strongly point in their own way to non-unitarity.
All right, so
I suggest we sum up the formal part of the seminar and keep talking.
Yeah, we can talk about maybe doing this experiment. If we isolate a system for a sufficiently long time, who's going to bet that it will eventually violate the Born rule?
Well, we can just stay here for a few years.
Let's put a particle in a box somewhere. Mind you, we're going to need an ensemble, because anyway.
I'm assuming we've already ended the formal seminar, but let me suggest another question that I often ask, you could ask your friends also, is what are the experimental bounds on unitarity violations? Almost no one. It's another one of these questions like what you say people don't pay attention to.
Yes, I remember one
way of
I remember once thinking about this. You know, how well do we know the Born rule works in, say, high energy physics? And you try and look in the literature, and actually, it's not something you really think about.
How well do we know unitarity?
Yeah.
I mean, they're connected, but you can do some experiments to test, but people don't seem very interested.
No, but, you know, I mean, it's one of these things that, you know, when there isn't a theory that indicates a certain kind of effect might be possible, then people don't think about it. And the sort of point of view that I've presented here, I think it gives you a way of thinking about how actually that there is a, within the context of this theory, there are natural ways in which these kinds of effects could be described consistently and could occur, and so maybe we should look for them. That's a good point too. So shall we retire to the bistro and
shall we
Sorry, and thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.